Today on Against the Grain, the power the police wield on the streets of this country is plain to see. Less visible, but no less formidable, is the immense political power and influence that the police exercise. Historian Stuart Schrader describes how police unions amassed enormous power over the last 50 years. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When the largest social movement in U.S. history demanded police accountability and defunding, it ran into the tremendous political power of the police and police unions. In a country where unions have been historically weak, how did police unions build such power? Stuart Schrader answers that question in his book, Blue Power, How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. He's associate professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. Stuart, how would you characterize the extent of the political power of the police?
The police in the United States wield enormous amounts of power. I think the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements put a very strong awareness in many people's heads of the ways that police enact power on the streets, both in everyday encounters and when they control protests and other types of social mobilizations. But I think we've paid less attention to the ways that police wield power behind closed doors, the way that they engage in political maneuvers, the way they try to shape our politics at city, state, and federal levels, and the ways they often use politics to their advantage, trying to shape the very understanding of crime and public safety that many Americans hold. So we've paid less attention to that, and to the degree that people have been attuned to political maneuvers of police, they generally have considered it sort of a natural feature of our politics. It's just normal that a police union leader in a given city is always at odds with the mayor or the city council. It's a normal thing for a police union to attack and blast elected officials on social media. You know, we've taken it for granted that this is just the way things work. And so what I've tried to do in this book, Blue Power, is to say, first, we do need to pay attention to that kind of behind-the-scenes maneuvering, those political machinations that police have been engaging in, and also that this is not necessarily a natural feature of our politics. We shouldn't think of it as something that should go unquestioned. In fact, we should question it, and we should know that it has a history. It wasn't always this way. Before the 1960s, it really wasn't the case that we could say that in cities or in state legislatures or in Washington that the police were able to consistently get what they wanted from elected officials.
And we'll talk about that change, because you're right. As you say, there's, I think, an assumption that given the extent of police power, that police have always been that powerful. But I wanted to ask you, just to put that power in some context, how would you compare the power of police unions to other public workers in the United States?
The police union movement came into existence in its modern iteration at the same time as most other public sector unions came into existence. There was a massive wave of public sector unionization that began in the 1960s. In part, this was consistent with the broader social mobilizations of the 60s for greater rights and equality. But it was also the result of some very specific changes to local and state law, support that came all the way from the White House. Kennedy and Johnson supported public sector unionization. So police unions formed out of the same moment of legal changes. They were able to take advantage of new possibilities to form unions, bargain for contracts, gain access to grievance procedures, gain access to arbitration procedures at the same time as other unions for sanitation workers, for teachers, etc. So at the outset of that process, there was a real question that both organized labor had to contend with and police unions had to contend with, which was, are we one and the same? Are these two movements connected? Are police unions meant to be part of the same organizations as other workers? And I think it probably won't surprise your listeners to learn that it ultimately came to be the case that for the most part, police unions chose a different path. They took advantage of the same legal changes, the same energy that powered the public sector union movement, but largely they stood aside from it, worked separately, created their own institutions. And part of the reason for this was historical in that there were pre-existing organizations, benevolent associations, fraternities, etc., that police belonged to, but these had existed as kind of social organizations. In some cases, they provided insurance for officers and their families. In some cases, they were kind of like credit unions. They weren't part of the already existing labor movement. So when these organizations started to try to bargain collectively, they weren't coming at it from a tradition of unionism. They were coming at it from a tradition of protecting officers and supporting their families and being, in many cases, insular social clubs or police officers.
How did the U.S. labor movement traditionally, at least, regard the police? Because, of course, on a picket line, it might be police who'd be bludgeoning you as a striker.
When police first started to engage in union-like activities, some of them did reach out to the traditional labor movement. They reached out to the AFL-CIO, Teamsters, etc., these kind of large, you know, labor organizations, many of which were at the height of their power in the 1960s. And they asked, can we be a part of your movement? Can we gain some lessons on how to operate as unions? Can we draw on your experience and know-how in negotiations and the legislative process, etc.? And it was the case that some union officials were open to collaboration with the police, particularly the more public sector-oriented parts of the labor movement, especially AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. But a lot of labor leaders said, why on earth would we organize alongside cops? They've been the ones who've been breaking our strikes, arresting us at protests, and in some cases, you know, brutalizing us when we try to, you know, interfere with the operations of factories and other industries. There's been decades of history of police being the ones who are protecting scabs, who are breaking picket lines, etc. Why on earth would we want to collaborate with these guys? And on the other side, there were many police themselves who were really, really skeptical of any sort of affiliation with the labor movement. They would say, the labor movement is full of communists. It's, you know, full of reds and pinkos. We don't trust them. They don't have our best interests at heart. So there was mutual suspicion, mutual animosity, and that prevented some of the ties from forming that some of the advocates of those types of affiliations had hoped for. But it was nevertheless the case that the police unions did learn from, imitate, copy and even, you know, steal the ideas from the labor movement. And it has also been the case that in the years since that kind of initial moment when police unions formed in the late 1960s and early 70s in many cities, they've had much better fortunes than the both private sector labor movement and public sector movement. You know, organized labor has been suffering misfortune after misfortune over the decades, and the same cannot be said about police unions.
Were there constraints on police organizing in unions before the 1960s in terms of labor law in the state?
Yeah, it would be different from one state to the next, but in general, there were constraints, there were limitations. The police would sometimes make the argument that the law allowed them to unionize, and sometimes it would go to court, or sometimes the, you know, governor or mayor would just issue a decree saying no way. So it did require an organized effort to overcome the resistance of governors, mayors, and especially police chiefs. In fact, it was the case that in many cities, the biggest impediment was the police command, because the police unions often got their start, or the unionization efforts got their start, because police rank and file were opposed to the ways that chiefs and commanding officers ran police departments. They thought they were too authoritarian. They thought they were too, sort of top down in their management styles. The police officers wanted to change work means to make it better for them, whereas the police chiefs in most cases wanted to change work routines to, you know, deal with social problems, crime, etc. And they didn't really see eye to eye. And so the police chiefs generally were resistant to empowering the rank and file, because they knew that if they did that, it would create the possibility that police would be able to resist command imperatives and changes to work routines, etc.
Right, and this division within the police, that is, of the police chiefs and the rank and file, is an important one in this story about police organizing themselves collectively. And I wanted to ask you, before we turn to the 1960s, where the tension between the chiefs and the rank and file police really started bubbling up, I wanted to ask you, did rank and file police engage in disruptive collective action before the 1960s, before they were organizing themselves in the kind of unions we'd recognize, like through striking or sick outs or other such actions?
There was a really famous incident in 1919 in Boston, which was an episode where the Boston police officers tried to form a union, and they tried to affiliate with organized labor, the mainstream of the labor movement. And the officials in Boston said, no way, and the police went on strike. And it became a crisis kind of situation. There was arson and looting and mayhem. And the eventual result was that the governor of Massachusetts had to get involved and put down the strike. That was a guy named Calvin Coolidge, who then kind of rode the fame that he earned from putting down the police strike all the way into the White House. And so from 1919 until the 1960s, there was a lot of hesitancy among police about engaging in illegal strike activity or other types of collective action like that, because it had backfired so spectacularly in 1919 and had, you know, ushered in a president who himself was not really any friend of the labor movement. It's not to say that there was never any sort of collective action or efforts to unionize before the 1960s, but it wasn't really until around 1966, 67 that police started to engage in slowdowns, walkouts, etc. And that moment is really where my book's narrative begins.
I'm speaking with historian Stuart Schrader about his book, Blue Power, How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. Then take us to the late 1960s, this time when the police rank and file started to organize itself in earnest. Can you just remind us of the social context in which such efforts by the police took place?
The middle of the 1960s was a moment of great social turbulence in the United States. On the one hand, the civil rights movement was at its peak. It had made really impressive legislative gains with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. At the same time, the war in Vietnam was also ramping up. The student mobilization against that war and the broader anti-war movement was growing. And there was, of course, despite the gains of the civil rights movement, still a great deal of anger and frustration felt in many Black neighborhoods across cities of the United States, which turned into the rebellions of Watts in 1965, Harlem and Bed-Stuy in 1964, and perhaps most famously, Newark and Detroit in 1967. And of course, there were hundreds of other towns and cities across the country where there were rebellions and unrest. The urban rebellions played an important role in the effort by police to assert their political power. But I think that it is a somewhat counterintuitive way. On the one hand, the rebellions had the effect of empowering the police chiefs because they proposed a set of solutions to urban rebellion. They said, okay, look, to some degree, it's true that we police have not done a great job of preventing and tamping down this wave of rebellion. But we also know the answer. We need to reform policing. We need to train our officers better. We need to recruit according to higher standards. In effect, we need to upgrade and modernize and reform policing as it exists. The rank and file, on the other hand, were generally quite conservative, and they saw these rebellions as, you know, attacks on social order, and they saw them also in many cases as attacks on police themselves. And so they responded to the rebellions, really by rejecting them, but then also by, if not rejection, skepticism of the kind of, again, top-down reform measures that the police chiefs were trying to impose. The chiefs were successful in 1968 in getting legislation passed, the biggest anti-crime bill that had ever been issued was passed in 1968, and that sent a lot of money from Washington all around the country to many, many police forces in order to pay for new training, new types of experimental methods that might reform and transform policing and make it more effective. And it also bears mentioning that this moment was a period when violent crime was on the increase and police were, in some cases, getting the blame for not being able to take control of the growing crime problem. And so, again, chiefs proposed a set of reform measures in order to gain control over the crime problem. But rank and file police, the police unions, they used this kind of social disorder and mayhem that was represented both by the rebellions and by the increasing crime as a kind of platform on which they could say police need greater support, better salaries, better protections from discipline and punishment in order to get a hold on everything that's going wrong in society. And that powered the police union movement, the displeasure at the reform measures and the anger at the social upheaval that was occurring.
And how did that organization start? How did police link up with each other in that period in the mid-1960s?
There were different initial incidents that propelled unionization, but very quickly, people who were interested, officers who were interested in trying to form unions, started to get in touch with one another. So you would have somebody from Philadelphia travel to Baltimore, or somebody from New York travel to Detroit, or something like that. A national network of people interested in unionizing police very quickly formed. And they traded lessons. They, you know, had ideas about best practices. Here's what worked in our city. Here's what didn't work. And so there was a growing national conversation quite quickly that developed in the late 1960s. And already by the very beginning of the 1970s, police were trying to take their message to Washington. There's a photo that I have in the book of thousands of police officers who gathered on the steps of the Capitol building in Washington when they were trying to get the attention of Congress, hoping to have Congress pass certain types of legislation that would protect police, but also as a way of saying, look, there's a lot of us, we're organized, we're going to speak with a unified, coherent voice. And it wasn't really the case that Congress was ready to listen to this kind of unified voice of police, but that kind of organizing paid off certainly at the municipal and then state levels quite quickly.
And why was that? I mean, you write that it hasn't always been the case that democratically elected politicians, mayors and other representatives in cities would essentially take their marching orders from the police, which I think could broadly characterize things now. So why was it that these figures were receptive to the agenda of the police then?
I think there were two factors. The first factor is that particularly among Democrats, but also some Republicans, they were supportive of organized labor. They were supportive of public sector unionization. They saw the effort to improve working conditions and increase, compensation in order to attract better recruits as worthwhile. At the same time, elected officials in any city are worried about increasing crime. And it was the case that in the 1960s, the kind of playbook of denouncing elected officials when crime goes up and, you know, blaming them for that playbook really started to come into existence. And the police union movement was a part of it. The police union leaders very quickly learned how to instrumentalize crime fears and even, you know, crime statistics for their own benefit. So there was, you know, support from the from many elected officials for unionization broadly. They wanted to be very careful about rising crime, but it also quickly became clear that police were able to induce various types of chaos that no mayor wanted to experience. So there were, you know, walkouts and strikes in cities all over the country by police. I start the book with a incident of so-called blue flu calling out sick en masse in Detroit. And that happened right before the 1967 rebellion. And this is largely forgotten. I think many, many people know at least a little bit about the 1967 rebellion, but almost nobody remembers that it was preceded by this intense mobilization by Detroit police to try to overcome the mayor's resistance to their unionization drive and their effort to get a contract. There were strikes, in wildcat strikes in New York City. There was a strike in Baltimore. There was a strike in San Francisco. Both of those I spend a lot of time in the book investigating. So these strikes often resulted in chaos, in, you know, arson, looting. They paralyzed cities. And so even if officials were, somewhat supportive of unionization efforts, police were able to force officials to concede to them by going on strike. Now, again, many public sector unions went on strike in the 1970s, and of course, sanitation strikes are kind of the most common example of a strike that by public workers that makes everybody in the city miserable. But police strike had a kind of special power because elected officials were so worried about, you know, resulting crime sprees and, other forms of chaos. And in the case in Baltimore of the police strike there, it coincided with a sanitation strike. So really, almost every public sector worker in the city went on strike simultaneously, but it was the police strike that really turned it into a situation of chaos and had quite dramatic effects in the city.
What can you tell us more about those moments? You mentioned San Francisco as one example of how the police exercising their power affected the city.
The San Francisco police strike in the middle of the 1970s came on the heels of a concerted organizing campaign by the Police Officers Association. That police union had been taken over by a group of younger officers who were pretty militant, and their demands largely were oriented toward better compensation and also relaxation of some departmental rules. They wanted to get rid of patronage structures. So they were battling against city officials, in some cases collaborating with city officials. But it came to a head when the city, as many cities in the middle of the 1970s, was suffering a set of, you know, really severe fiscal challenges. And the Board of Supervisors said, we just can't afford to give you the raise you're demanding. And the San Francisco police officers at that time were basically the best paid officers in the state. And they wanted more money. When the Board of Supervisors, which was led by Dianne Feinstein at the time, said no to the raise they demanded, the officers went out on strike. And it was a multi-day strike. There were crime sprees, and police themselves engaged in a lot of vandalism, both on the streets, but also, you know, not every police officer went on strike. So the ones who went on strike sometimes got in fights with officers who didn't go on strike. They vandalized their cars or, you know, slashed their tires or whatever. So it was a pretty chaotic situation. And the, you know, mayor ultimately actually was able to bring the strike to a close against the wishes of the Board of Supervisors by kind of invoking somewhat questionable legal strategy. The outcome of the strike was not necessarily all beneficial for the police union. And this is one of the points I make throughout the book, is that although these police unions exercised power in really dramatic ways, it didn't always mean that they got exactly what they wanted or they got the benefits that they wanted. But they were consistent and kind of relentless in pushing forward to the next battle. And the San Francisco Police Union, at the same time as had some setbacks after the strike, it nevertheless managed to figure out, like, well, if we can't get what we want in the city from the Board of Supervisors or the mayor, maybe we can get what we want from the state legislature and the governor. And they designed a strategy in Sacramento that proved really, really effective. They were kind of pioneers of using the state legislature as a way to get what they couldn't get from the local city elected officials. Ultimately, that kind of strategy has become quite common for police unions all over the country.
Well, can you tell us more about that strategy and where else that it was so effective in increasing the power of the police?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of using the state legislature is that if you can get something enshrined in state law, then it will apply to every police department around the state. So if you have a recalcitrant city council, the police might be able to basically overrule them by getting the state legislature to pass a law. And so in California, for example, one of the goals of the San Francisco Police Officers Association, which they brought to the state legislature, was to institute what is called a Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. It's basically a set of policies and procedures that protect officers in cases of discipline or, you know, investigations for misconduct. In some cities, like, for example, New York City, where the idea sort of originated, this was something that was built into the union contract. But union contracts are always negotiable. There's many factors that go into the signing of a union contract. And of course, a union contract only covers one city. So the idea that the San Francisco officers had was like, well, if we really want to make sure that this is rock solid, we should get it signed in the state legislature.
I'm speaking with Stuart Schrader about his book, Blue Power, How Police Organized to Protect and Serve Themselves. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So in the period that you're describing, this period of increased power of the police and the police finding ways at multiple levels to increase their power, increase their leverage, that was also a period where cities found themselves struggling with their budgets and having enough resources. How did this increased power and the demands of the police, including for protections and, of course, benefits and higher wages, how did that affect the ordinary residents of cities?
City budgets are finite, and police know it. I was surprised in my research to find example after example where police union officials would acknowledge that the city was running out of money. But their response was never to say, okay, we're all in this together. We'll take a pay cut because we recognize that the city is at risk of not being able to pay the bills. Instead, what they would say was, you better pay the police and cut the budget for libraries, parks and rec, road maintenance, you know, you name it. They would over and over again insist police are the most important service that a city provides, and every other service should be subject to cuts, but not police. Now, many people would agree with that argument, but I found myself to be surprised at how explicit police officers themselves were in making it. And I think they kind of set the tone that then other elected officials and certainly, you know, voters and commentators in the press adopted. And it has remained the case all the way up until the present that police do manage to see increases in their budgets, even as, you know, other city services, parks and rec is a great example, you know, their budgets are flatlined or they have to form, you know, kind of public-private partnerships in order to find, you know, resources to operate the parks. So this is a practice that we see going on in city after city of police resisting the kind of fiscal austerity that is imposed on, you know, other parts of the city government. Now, it is the case that in some cities, police have suffered budget cuts, they have suffered layoffs, but when the, you know, budget goes back into the black, they tend to be the ones who get their coffers replenished first.
Right. And is it not the case that some cities pay as much as 40% of their budget to the police, to say nothing of money allocated for settling lawsuits around police brutality?
Absolutely. Yeah, the settlement question is an important one, because this is another way that taxpayers are on the hook for the costs that police incur. And it is certainly true that in many cities, settlements for incidents of police abuse and even killing of people, you know, these can run into the, you know, hundreds of million dollars per year. And almost never is it the case that police themselves as individuals or police unions have to contribute to those settlement costs. There are a few examples where it has been the case, if unions are implicated in forms of illegal conduct, that they have had to pay out. But it's very, very rare. Usually it just comes out of the city budget or other types of funds that taxpayers are on the hook for. And even if they did come out of city police union budgets, at the end of the day, those are paid for by tax dollars anyway, because the money that police unions draw upon is dues collected out of police officers' salaries.
How did the efforts of the police, you know, you've been describing the 60s into the 70s, how did their political power grow? Because your book describes organizing that takes place within cities, and yet obviously the police became savvier and savvier, operating on a state level and then linking up on a national level, and certainly there is tremendous national power that the police have now. How was that coordinated?
The police union movement, the Fraternal Order of Police, for example, and other organizations tried to get the attention of Washington as early as the beginning of the 70s, but they weren't all that successful at first. What started to change was a new crop of legislators coming into office who were largely what we would recognize as tough-on-crime Democrats. The most notable figure like this was Senator Joe Biden, but there were a number of others who started to become open to, you know, listening to police, advocating for what they wanted in Congress. And at the same time, as you suggest, police became more savvy. They learned their way around the halls of Congress. You know, figuring out how to get your way in a city, working with city council or the mayor, is quite different from the complexity of the House and the Senate, because of course there are committees and subcommittees and all kinds of arcane rules. So it took a while for police union officials to sort of figure out the ways of Washington, but they were oftentimes guided and led by some of these tough on crime elected officials. Again, Biden is a notable example. There's another guy I spent some time writing about in the book, who is Mario Biaggi, who was a congressman who had actually been a police officer himself from New York City. And Biaggi and his staff made the decision to teach police officers how Congress worked, to give them ideas about when certain legislation was coming up. This is who you need to talk to. This is who you need to make the case to. This is the person who might be holding up a vote, et cetera, et cetera. So the role of an individual like Mario Biaggi was actually quite important, because without that sort of shepherd in Congress, some of the legislative gains that police were trying to get in Washington might have been impossible. They needed a figure who could help the different police organizations cohere. You know, many of them didn't get along with each other. They're, you know, it's a big country. There's a lot of organizations. There's a lot of different interests, you know, urban, rural, city, state, county, etc. You know, they didn't all see eye to eye. And of course, chiefs and rank and file were oftentimes at odds. So you needed an individual with a certain amount of authority and clout who could help get everybody in the room and find commonalities among the different agendas. And so Biagi and Biden in the book I show were two of the most important figures in that way in Washington.
Stuart Schrader, can you talk about the affinities of the two political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, to the police, and how the division that you mentioned earlier between the police chiefs who had organized themselves in their own union and who the rank and file police organized unions partially in opposition to their dictates, how the Democrats and Republicans related differently to these two sectors of these two parts of the police, and the particular role that the Democrats played. I mean, you've just been mentioning Joe Biden in being the most vociferous boosters of the police, but taking a particular orientation politically.
Democrats across the country tended to support the chiefs in the end of the 1960s and even through the 70s and into the 80s. The reason was that Democrats often supported the technocratic reform agendas of many of the most powerful police chiefs in this period. Democrats thought that to the degree that their agenda, and I guess I would say I'm mainly talking about more Northern Democrats, not Southern Democrats, they saw the police chief's reform agenda as compatible with pushes for civil rights, for greater equality, etc. The police union movement was always interested in what we might call law and order politics, a real tough on crime agenda, sort of lock them up and throw away the key. And, you know, it wasn't exclusively Republicans who were espousing this, but obviously this was the watchword of figures like Richard Nixon and then, you know, Ronald Reagan. And that kind of division between a reform orientation from the top of the police hierarchy being associated with the Democrats and the real tough on crime rank and file police being associated more with Republicans did ultimately create some challenges, because by the time a really large crime bill is coming up for a vote in Congress, it was necessary in this period to find some commonality across that sort of divide. And it wasn't really until the 1994 crime bill, which was absolutely shepherded through by Democrats, Joe Biden and Bill Clinton, Joe Biden in the Senate and Bill Clinton in the White House. But it offered something to all parties. It offered benefits to police rank and file in the promise of enough funding to hire 100,000 new officers across the country. This was Bill Clinton's kind of bottom line about that legislation. 100,000 new cops is what would result, and they would engage in community-oriented policing. But it also offered a number of racial justice measures and other reform measures that appeased more, you know, liberal Democrats and so forth. So big legislation is hard to pass, increasingly harder and harder to pass. But in order to get it across the line, it has to offer something to multiple constituencies. And in the 1990s, again, because of the kind of organizing work to get police in, from different perspectives all in the room talking to one another, that people like Biden did, they were able to craft legislation that was palatable to sort of both sides of that, both partisan, but also, you know, kind of political division within the profession of policing.
Because of time, I'm just jumping a little bit ahead here. So in recent years, in the 2010s, there was a growing movement against police brutality. And then, of course, in 2020, culminating with the largest protest movement in U.S. history against the police killing of George Floyd. At that point, the police had consolidated enormous power. Was that power challenged in that moment? And if not, why not?
I think that the moment of Black Lives Matter protest in 2020 and some years earlier, 2014, 2015, did pose a challenge to the political power of police. But because police had been so well organized, so adept at getting their way in state legislatures, certainly in arbitration proceedings, you know, in the kind of labor setting, it was very, very hard for this movement that burst onto the scene out of anger, indignation, hurt, pain. You know, it was really hard for this movement to be able to marshal the same types of organization and kind of political savvy and staying power that police unions had. It's nevertheless the case that in the years since the 2020 protests and rebellions, more and more progressive elected officials are getting elected, whether it's, you know, city councils or state legislatures, and whether they're members of, you know, DSA or just more progressive Democrats. It's really true that people who are clued into the kind of politics of Black Lives Matter and critical of policing are now in positions of elected power and authority. So that does not mean that police unions are, you know, on their heels or are, you know, at risk of being defeated. But they're encountering a new type of political situation that is a bit unfamiliar. And I really don't think that they are, in many cities, quite as powerful as they were, you know, in decades past. I think the kind of best indicator of this is that some police unions are looking to Washington for assistance. The police union of the Washington, D.C. Police Department is the kind of best example of this. And of course, Washington, D.C. has a particular political status that allows Congress to have some influence over the city. But that police union, when faced with progressives on the city council who are really trying to fairly dramatically transform what policing in the city looks like, they've run to Congress and to really conservative MAGA members of Congress for help. So the necessity of doing that sort of thing is, from their perspective, I think, created by the power of progressive elected officials on the city council who really have taken to heart many of the lessons of the movements of the past decade plus.
But even with those caveats, obviously the movement to defund the police really foundered, and I'm curious to know what you think it might take, given the enduring power of the police, for social movements to actually, you know, significantly restrain the police or defund them.
Well, I would say that, you know, Blue Power, the title of my book, is also a kind of explanation for, on the one hand, why the argument arose that police needed to be defunded. They've used their power to accumulate enormous amounts of the public purse, and they've also used their power to create a situation of widespread impunity. There's very little risk of severe punishment for misconduct. So Blue Power explains why people started to make the argument that police needed to be defunded. But I think Blue Power also explains why that movement for defunding was not ultimately all that successful, even though it was an idea espoused by literally millions of Americans. So the question of how to mitigate and lessen the political power of police is a difficult and complicated one. But I do think that, as I've been suggesting, you know, political shifts that remove some of the most reliable allies in positions of legislative authority is one important step. It doesn't mean that legislation that will constrain police would be easy to pass, but it becomes much easier when there are greater numbers of progressive officials. At the same time, I also think that there needs to be a continued strategy of protest, mobilization, and direct action, changing public consciousness so that the way that police have been able to dominate conversations about crime and public safety and other aspects of our politics is lessened and weakened. Police have too much ability to shape the kind of public sphere when it comes to these matters. And the Black Lives Matter movement was able to change the conversation, but I think it still needs to continue to be transformed, and pressure definitely needs to be mounted somewhat relentlessly. Because in fact, part of the reason that police have been so successful politically is because of their own relentlessness.
And lastly, Stuart, would it make an impact or a significant impact for unions to kick the police out of the labor movement?
I do think that the labor movement should kick police out. At the same time, police have already learned so much from the labor movement. They have so much experience and know-how that it's not totally clear to me that it would dramatically change the way that police unions operate. But I do think, nevertheless, that the ongoing efforts in SEIU and some other unions to push police out, I think these are really valid objectives, and they have been really important organizing tools to change people's consciousness and also understanding of what the purpose of the labor movement is in the first place. I would just say, why include within the labor movement, which is organized around the fundamental principle of solidarity, why include organizations that are unwilling to extend that solidarity, but instead largely just work in their own interests?
Stuart Schrader, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stuart Schrader is the author of Blue Power, How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. He's Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University and Director of the Chloe Center for the Critical Study of Racism, Immigration, and Colonialism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.